I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. Today, my guest is Jeff Hancock, CEO of CoinPass. Tune in to this conversation as we discuss why you'd be crazy not to be in crypto in 2024, how crypto can help you become financially free, why crypto right now can lead to life-changing wealth. Hi, Jeff. Thank you so much for being a guest in my home today. And I am super, super, super excited. In fact, so excited I'm going to fall off my chair because we are about to talk about one of my favorite topics, that little controversial topic called crypto and how it links to financial freedom. But before we get going, can you tell me a bit about yourself, Jeff, who you are and what you do?
Thank you very much for having me, Sonia. It's good to be here. Obviously, coming on to the podcast, firstly, but also being invited in your home is a very, very personal touch, which I quite like. Very cool. So I started out life in tech. I've always been in tech. I started out in hotels and casinos in Australia, in infrastructure and cybersecurity. So taking care of all the staff, all the servers, all the different types of departments that work with each other, all the way up to the guests of the hotel. Roughly about 4,000 staff or 10,000 guests at any one time, and they're all relying on tech to make sure the show keeps running. I moved to the UK in 2010, looked after data centers for a while, and we had a lot of like food brands like Goo Puddings or Ella's Kitchen. We looked after a lot of financial firms and did a lot of different projects in a lot of different kind of sectors. And then when I was able to finally get off my working visa, because obviously coming here from Australia, I had to be on a working visa, did a little bit of time at SoftBank, at the Vision Fund, which is a £100 billion startup investing in other companies. And just being in that kind of atmosphere, I was consulting for one brand, I had some property on the side as well, and I kind of dipped my toe a little bit into crypto. And it wasn't until about 2017 or so when my now co-founders came to me and said, Jeff, you've been doing this crypto thing a little while. How do we buy, £5,000 or £10,000 worth of Bitcoin without US dollars? My simple answer in 2017 was you can't. It's either too expensive or too slow or too cumbersome. Just take the FX fee and move on. And that's how the idea of CoinPass kind of started, was why can't we build something better?
What was your sort of, or why were you so passionate, or were you passionate about crypto? Was it just something you fell into?
I suppose I was passionate about it because it was such a new type of technology and it had a kind of unlimited depth. And if you're anything into research or being on YouTube at 2 a.m. and going down the rabbit hole, it's kind of one of those topics that kind of doesn't have an end. And in crypto, when we talk about crypto as a token or a currency, that's kind of the top layer. You have to go another level down to what we call the blockchain and that technology that it's built on. That's where all the opportunities or all the possibilities are. Just like how we think of the internet now. We see Wi-Fi on our phone, we're on the internet. Well, actually, that's a phone connecting to a network and the network going through the wiring and that connecting. There's a lot of steps along the way. And crypto and blockchain and everything else underneath it, that's kind of where all the different levels of kind of building blocks are. And that's why, from a technical perspective, kind of fell in love with it, kind of had a lot of passion because I understood it. I could teach people with it. I could make it simple. And I could also help them kind of with their security and making sure they never lost any of their crypto.
Now, you mentioned you were also into property as well. Tell me a little bit about that, because clearly there's a lot of entrepreneurial spirit in you.
So that was my kind of first ever business here in the UK. I tried a number of different things and I was kind of guessing my way through it and obviously with very little success. And I went out to an event, read some books, met a few people and learned about how you could kind of get into property without having to be mortgageable, and I was brand new in this country and I wanted to try something. And what I found was I was very good at finding deals or doing the calculations or working out all the little kind of nooks and crannies about putting together a property deal or working with people and raising finance. And I actually raised quite a lot of money for other people's projects before I ever did one of my own. And being in that network and just having everyone around me, I learned very quickly that property is more of a people business than it is about assets and land and registry. So many of those relationships or so many of those factors that goes into a property business before you even look at a mortgage or a bit of land or refurbing it, is there's a lot of things that are outside of your control.
Massively.
There are a lot of people that are trained by the person before them. They're not, you know, CPD accredited, or they're not regulated, or there's a lot of things that if a valuer gets up on the wrong side of the bed, you know, that can affect your your bottom line. And the more and more and more I learned about the property business, I was really good at the people side and I was really good at raising money. But when it came to kind of after doing the deal and operating it, I found that quite boring.
The reason I'm sort of laughing is I do have a property portfolio, and when people say passive income, I can think of there is nothing passive about it. But it does give you financial freedom.
It can if done in the right way. And I think if you seek out the right training, you know, you don't have to pay for it. I think you just need to be persistent and actually see who knows what and detect who doesn't know anything, because there are a lot of people that are just course junkies. I think getting down to the core principles of running a successful property business is, you know, not just when you buy, when you sell, but I think the areas you choose and where you choose to put your time. Because I ran up and down the country for about a year, every weekend looking at every different place in the UK before I finally settled on somewhere. But that is probably something I could have done from the comfort of my own home. But yet I was, you know, 40, 50 hours a week in my tech job, on trains up and down the country every weekend. So burning through a lot of capital, easily doing 20 to 30 hours on the weekends trying to see all these properties. And I was thinking about putting offers in and trying to find something I could afford versus doing proper due diligence and learning more about the business I actually wanted to create. Mm. So that was probably one of my earliest learnings, was not leveraging what I'm really good at, which is tech and systems and discovery and putting things together. I was trying to jump straight to how do I get the money in my bank account? And that's where I think a lot of people can go wrong without getting the proper training or the proper research to know what they're good at and what they're not good at.
I completely agree. And I think there's, and look, I'm not here knocking property. It's got me to where I've got to. I love it. But I think people think it's easier than it is, and it's a lot more passive than it is.
It's a lot more competitive than people give it credit for as well. I was bidding on properties in the Midlands and in Lincolnshire, specifically to do either multi-let or to do title splits. Those are the two strategies I wanted to follow. And what I found was that even though I was finding decent deals, talk with the agents, I had a builder in the area. I had people that would almost go and view the properties for me at some point when I was in Mayfair quite a lot. I can't get up to that part of the country every single week. I would put in above market, pretty like serious offers with due diligence behind it, and you have a cash buyer that would just outbid you by 50 grand. And then 3 months later, the property comes back on the market because the sale fell through. And that was just a rinse and repeat for about 12 to 18 months. I would put, I'd see 20, 30 properties. I'd put two or three offers in that either get rejected or outbid. Do I want to rebid again? I said, well, no, they're outside of my, you know, risk or outside of my budget or outside, I don't think that property is worth that. And my bid would go to zero or get thrown out. And then the same property come back on the market from a bad buyer not completing the sale. So it was this very unfulfilling grind of trying to get even my first deal through the door. Meanwhile, I raised close to £2.5 million for other people's deals simply by being on WhatsApp and being out in London two nights a week.
So in terms of property, and I guess drawing a parallel to crypto, do you see anything similar?
I do see similarities, and I think I see similarities in the type of archetype or investor type that will kind of get into crypto. And that's where I kind of started earlier, is there's kind of something in crypto for everybody. Whether you're a long-term investor, like a property investor, you can follow buying the same amount every week, like dollar cost averaging, using crypto or certain tokens as part of your like retirement portfolio, you know, like putting money into your SIP or putting money into your ISA, similar activities to that. You know, with a property that you might put capital into it and then get some sort of cash flow off it. There are different types of crypto assets out there where you can buy them and stake them to get a recurring income off them, you know. So I think there are some parallels in the investors that want to come into the space that aren't interested in trading, that don't want to sit there and look at a screen all day. But I think there are definitely some activities on blockchain and some activities in crypto that relate very heavily to the type of people that are interested in property. And that's just whether there are so many different elements of crypto that there is something for everybody.
Yeah, as we stand today, and it's January 2024, we have a lot of people that invest or want to invest in properties. Probably a lot of people that are nervous about crypto, and even that word crypto can send people into shivers. It's a little bit like the Brexit word a few years ago. As soon as I say, oh no, I invest in crypto, people are like, ah, Why do you think that is? If I play devil's advocate, what I hear a lot is, well, you can see property as bricks and mortar. What is crypto?
So in that same vein, I think crypto has an image problem. And I think it has from its kind of early days, and it hasn't managed to shake it, no matter how much good it's done. And a lot of people don't even see the good. Like, we look after a fair number of charities here in the UK that have accounts with our platform. We put the fees down basically as low as they can go. You can't times anything by zero, or you'd rip the fabric of the universe, I'm assuming. So we help charities with an account, and they can basically take donations in any of the tokens we support. And that's given them an avenue to get out to a global audience of crypto entrepreneurs or crypto traders that might, you know, see a relevance with that charity, and they can give, right? And that's one of the good sides of crypto. Look at all the funding that went into the Ukraine when the Ukraine conflict first started. They raised over $80 to $100 million in the first week, faster than anybody else, and actually got it to the front lines where it was needed, you know, and created a way for all those people to transact. Yet the only thing we see in the headlines is, some lawyer in Chichester loses $80,000 in Bitcoin to a romance scam. I was like, well, that's an old school fashion romance scam. That's nothing to do with crypto. And those are the headlines we kind of keep seeing over and over again. I think if we all kind of had a bit more education behind us on detecting a scam when someone's trying to take from us, getting a cold call, I think all of those kind of things would disappear. I think people would see crypto or the technology behind it as a way to make banking faster, cheaper, more efficient, self-sovereign in our wealth. I think there's a lot of good things that could come from it if we didn't focus on these little tiny fragments of bad news that actually have not that much to do with crypto at all.
Just going back to your expression there, self-sovereign of wealth, what do you mean by that, and how does crypto help in that?
When I say self-sovereign of wealth, like the money that's in your bank account, that's not yours. It's an IOU, right? So the bank will hold it on your behalf, but tomorrow they might find that you're doing too many podcasts on crypto and they might see you as a risk, so it'll freeze your account. But when your accounts are frozen, you can't unlock your own money unless you have a court order, right? And that could be I haven't had to go through that, thankfully, but I can imagine for the people that had their accounts frozen, they can't access the funds until they're unlocked. I can imagine that being very, very stressful. Now, being self-sovereign, or being kind of like your own bank, which means I can have my funds, like my Bitcoin, my stablecoin, my Ethereum, on a ledger, on a wallet, where I hold the private key.
What's for the audience, yeah. What is a private key?
A Bitcoin wallet, every wallet on every chain has two very key things. One's called the private key and one's called the public key. And if you think of both of those kind of like your bank card, right? So, or your bank account. So if I know your sort code and your account code, I can send you money, right? And that would be the public key. Pretty useless information, really. For me to try and steal from you, if I know your account number, I can't really do much, right? But the private key is kind of what controls the transactions. And that might be on the back of your credit card, like the little CCV. You know, the card number with the CCV and the date. All of those things control the transactions. So every crypto wallet has a public key to receive funds and a private key to basically move funds around or initiate transactions. And if I control my private key and no one can take it from me, not the police, not the central government, not the central bank, I could walk around literally with that private key around my neck. And I have done through an airport. And I did it as kind of a little bit of an exercise of, like, if I was going to escape tomorrow, what's my zombie apocalypse sort of, you know, not relying on banks, not relying on anything else, and moving my wealth around with me, as long as I find another crypto person that wants to transact, you know, we can transact without the use of a bank, without the use of British pounds, without the use of US dollars.
So why have we made this subject so, I guess, inaccessible? And why is it that the governments and banks are so against it?
I think they don't control it. That's one aspect of it. So banks control the flow of money. They work with central banks to, you know, help influence what the interest rate should be and who should have access to capital and who shouldn't, right? From small businesses, large businesses, different minorities, there's always going to be a problem with kind of money flow. So I wouldn't say they hate crypto, but they don't like this. They don't have any sort of influence or control over it because it's completely decentralized. We still don't know who created Bitcoin. You know, there's Bitcoin moving all over the internet, all over the world, and there's not one thing anyone can do to stop it. So that's probably a little bit of an intimidation bit. We can't control it and we can't stop it.
On a side note, we haven't actually mentioned this, but what is Bitcoin?
What is Bitcoin? Bitcoin is the original crypto, the OG, the Ford Model T. It was created in 2008, 2009 by a still unknown person or lady or people called Satoshi Nakamoto. That was their pseudonym they went under. And they created basically a piece of software, source code, that allowed the movement of a token or capital or money or whatever you want to call it, digital money, between two people without the use of a central third party. So, for example, if I wanted to send you £10 right now, I give you £10 in cash, and that's money that's been created by someone, a central bank. If I want to send it from my Revolut to your Starling account, we're relying on one bank to talk to another bank, right? So there's a lot of centralization in the middle there, and they could middle layer, they might say, oh, Jeff's overdrawn and we shouldn't send money to Sonia. We don't like these two people there. There's a lot of things in between that could stop that transfer from happening. Even if I send you that £10, I have to ask you, did you get the £10 I sent you? Because there's no way we can see behind the veil, right? There's nothing there.
Unless you're sitting there.
Unless you're sitting there. Even so, it could take 50 seconds or it could take 5 minutes. But we don't know, right? Now we look at the Bitcoin layer. As long as I've got a Bitcoin wallet and you've got a Bitcoin wallet, I can see your balance in real time. You can see my balance. So it's all fair. It's open. It's transparent. And I can send you a bit of Bitcoin from my wallet to your wallet in under 10 minutes for a very nominal, very, very cheap fee.
Presumably that eradicates terrorism, drug money, prostitute money.
It makes it the worst money laundering tool that there is. People will still use it because there's a level of anonymity. So a wallet address is just a string of numbers and letters. There's no name to it. As soon as it touches some sort of exchange like mine, that has a name and address attached to it, then yeah, you can kind of connect the dots. But until those dots are connected, then it doesn't matter if the Bitcoin wallet is in this room between two people or on the other side of the world. And that's actually the first time I ever used crypto, was to move some money from the UK to Australia just to give it to myself. Because we had a very, very first world problem. We had to put a pool fence around our pool. My mum's in her 60s. I didn't want her to pay for it. I want her to keep traveling. So I sent some money back home. And Barclays were going to take a week. It was going to take like 5%. And I went, it's high. Mm-hmm. An FX company was going to do 3 days. And the fee was, it was still quite high. Or I could use Bitcoin to do it. And I could send it to myself within about 10 minutes for about £1.20. So why wouldn't I use a faster, more efficient, cheaper method to moving value around? And that's why I've always been in crypto since 2016 after that.
So it's transparent. You can move it easily from A to B without fees or with just the very cheap fees. And it's accessible to everybody?
Pretty much everybody, yeah. The really only chokeholds on it now is, you could be a freelancer out there doing jobs and you can get paid in Bitcoin. Or you can use a platform like mine where you can sign up and you can exchange your pound sterling or your euros into a cryptocurrency. So there's still, the barrier to entry is you need to have some sort of proof of ID. That's about it. But crypto is designed to be for everyone. That was one of Satoshi Nakamoto's original, parts of his white paper about digital peer-to-peer money, was that it's available to everybody. And it was kind of in response to what was happening in the US and the global financial crisis in 2008.
Let's get down to the juicy stuff. We've just entered 2024, and I've heard that it's going to be a parabolic year for crypto, and people are going to make life-changing money. Are they? And why is it such an important year?
Well, I think it's an important year for a couple of reasons. One is every 4 years, specifically for Bitcoin, and Bitcoin's the biggest. It's got the biggest market cap. It's got the biggest history. Every 4 years, there's an event called the halving, where how the Bitcoin network works is there's a bunch of miners. They help all the transactions move around, and you have to pay to use the network, right? Similar to the bank example I said before, if I send you a £5 or £10 or whatever, it's free, right? We don't pay for that transfer because the banks use our money for other means and other activities. That's why it's free. But none of that exists on the Bitcoin networks. You have to pay for your transactions, right? Now, the Bitcoin miners that move the transactions around and they're incentivized to keep it moving, there's a reward every block. And that reward used to be 25 Bitcoin. per block, and then 4 years later it was halved to 12.5, and then it was halved to 6, and they're about to go through another halving again. So every 4 years, the amount of reward that a Bitcoin miner gets for running their operation, your revenue is halved. So there's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin in existence, ever. There's already 19 point something million in circulation. But yeah, those are some, that's the big macro factor, is every 4 years there's a halving. Obviously, history doesn't always repeat itself, but after a lot of the previous halvings, prices have gone up. Second part is, for a very long time, institutions have been trying to productize their own kind of Bitcoin funds or their own ETFs or their own way for institutional investors to access the market. But some of the key holds that they can't do, they can't hold the asset themselves. Which, like before, I was saying, I can carry my Bitcoin around on my neck. That's extremely risky for any normal investment firm or investment fund. That's why I usually see an investment fund, they have their trading desk, they work with a prime broker, and then a custodian will look after the stocks and the shares and everything they invest in. Very similar to crypto, they want to try and do the same thing, but storing crypto is incredibly hard and incredibly complex to make it 100% secure. Now those solutions have started to come around. Some of these ETF applications where institutional investors like banks, like pensions, like anyone with the appetite for it, will be able to access these kind of products. And they've taken a very, very long time to come to market. And 2024 is, I think, the year when we're going to see a few of them finally launch.
I mean, I spent 17 years in this city and worked with asset managers. And when Larry Fink, who's the CEO of BlackRock, I think it was literally about 6 months ago, came out and said Bitcoin was like gold, digital gold. That was probably one of the most biggest buying points, as far as I was concerned, having worked with asset managers.
The response for them is, you know, if we don't offer it, someone else will. So there's always going to be a race to, A, who can productize it and offer something to their clients. And we see that on a much smaller scale, you know, even with corporates here in the UK. We have a number of law firms that will take payment for their legal services in crypto because they have crypto clients. They might be here in the UK, they might be abroad, it doesn't matter. But they go, well, if we don't take, if they've asked us, can we pay for the services in crypto? They say no, there's nothing stopping them from shopping around and finding somewhere else. And so there's almost a race to, if we don't offer it, someone else will. And it's from the smallest stuff that we see all the way up to your big institutions and stuff. If they don't offer it, someone else will. We need to provide a product for our customers to make our customers happy, to kind of keep the wheel moving.
So most of your, let's get on to CoinPass. Are most of your customers at the moment retail, businesses?
We do both. So we started doing retail originally. That's what we thought our original audience was going to be. And the way we sort of appealed to people here in the UK was they could look in company sales and they could see a company with people in it. They could see we're registered here in the UK and we use UK banking. So that attracted kind of a different type of investor, that they have a property portfolio, or they're also a consultant, or they might be a retail person, but they kind of act like a sophisticated investor or corporate.
So you're FCA registered. How important is that?
I think for anyone investing in crypto, specifically in the UK, it's probably one of the most important things. We knew that regulation was going to come into this space eventually. Any market that becomes mature and becomes more accepted has a form of regulation on it. Look at the FX market 20 years ago, or look at the oil markets, etc. They didn't become as secure and prolific as they are without some form of regulation, and crypto is no different. So the FCA, we always knew they were going to come out with something. So 2018, when I first pitched this idea to my co-founders, I was like, look, it's not regulated now. It's a very Wild West thing, but if we do it properly, pretend like we're regulated, pretend like we're registered with some sort of license that doesn't yet exist, we can get ahead of the curve. So in 2018, we kind of pretended like we were like a prime broker or something similar to that. And we onboarded our customers in a certain way. We only use certain type of language in our marketing and our support content. And then when 2019, 2020 came around and the FCA put out a framework for people to apply to, we were able to kind of get through it. Actually, well, I say quite quickly, it was 18 months, but it's quicker than some other people, taking 3 or 4 years. So currently I think there's about 42 companies on that list that have the license. We were the third in the country to get that license out of about 450 companies that have applied. And some companies have applied and the FCA has kind of politely asked them to go away. Some other people have gone all the way through to an approval stage and just failed because they either don't have the experience, they don't understand the tech, or don't understand the duty of care they owe their responsible to their customers for. And that's why there are only 43 companies on that list. So it was kind of, I always thought it was a regulation part was very important for the industry to grow. But after 3 years and only 40 companies getting that license, it shows that only the top of the cream of the crop are able to do business here in the UK.
Why shouldn't I invest in crypto and use CoinPass?
Why shouldn't you invest in crypto and not use CoinPass? Well, if you don't like crypto for any reason, or you don't want to understand it, then you shouldn't invest in crypto at all. Flat trap. You know, you either like investing, you're interested in making money, you're interested in bettering yourself, learning something new. Some people are just so anti that they'll move on to something else, and that's fine. I'm not here to kind of preach to people and try and convert them. And why should you not use CoinPass? It's like, well, you can maybe onboard to other exchanges in other countries maybe a little bit easier. Ours is not very, you know, massively strict. You need an ID. You need a name first. You need an ID. Eventually a proof of address. And if that's too much for some people, then maybe we're not the platform for you. But the platforms that don't have any of those kind of requirements, they're the ones what we call an unlicensed exchange. And they're the ones that have usually either collapsed or disappeared or employed too much leverage or gone pop. So we think what we ask our customers to kind of, you know, not abide by, but the frameworks we follow from the FCA are very similar to what you see in CFDs and FX and those kind of trading markets, which is that crypto is going to move up to that kind of standard and that kind of quality. If you don't want to have that kind of relationship or interaction with an exchange, you'd rather just have a random email and a fake name on a crypto exchange, then that's fine, but I would be prepared to lose everything you put on that platform.
And how's it going to make me life-changing money?
Well, that comes with financial advice, which I can't give you. I would say this. I think if you apply yourself and, you know, actually think about all the upsides as well as the downsides and do a bit of a risk analysis and think, what is my opportunity of not doing this and missing out? Then people can make their own right decisions themselves. Some people see it's too risky and they can't lose that £50, or some people think there's a good opportunity in investing now for a longer term effect. To take it a step even further, I think having just a job is the riskiest thing people can do.
Absolutely, definitely.
Not taking interest in money, not taking interest in the future, not taking interest in
it. In your health, wealth.
Health, wealth and everything, it's all tied together. And I've had, you know, health problems related to stress in the past. I've had, and I know that if I go to the gym and I work really hard, I actually have a good positive, you know, vibe after that. When I was first getting started in property, my first business, and I learned a lot about people in my, you know, in my ecosystem, people in my community, how I could help them, how I could connect them, etc. And there were a lot of people that were very unhealthy, they didn't sleep, they didn't take care of themselves, and their personal life, your personal finance decisions, now amplified into a business, their businesses were never ever going to work. You know, they were running around chasing pennies and never being successful whatsoever, instead of focusing on the one thing they were really good at. I found that, okay, I'm in London, I've just arrived here, I'm not very mortgageable. In fact, one of my brokers said, like, you're better off just forgetting a mortgage. You're too Australian for a mortgage. I don't know what he means by that. But I focused on what I can do is I'm quite good at talking to people. So I just focused on putting people together and building systems for people and, you know, working my day job just to kind of pay the bills, but in evenings, nights and weekends, I was in my network trying to build, you know, build value in the way that I could with the very limited resources that I had. And in a year I raised, you know, £2 million for other people. And that was a really big achievement. So the next year I'm gonna do something bigger. But the next year I started doing my own deals. So that's how I started from one idea that I was really good at and rolling it into the next part of my business.
And I guess we're back then to the investor, the entrepreneurial mindset that we talked about at the beginning. We've gone full circle. Where do you see the future of CoinPass in the next 12 months? We've talked about this 2024. Yeah. Where do you see, what's your vision for it?
So it's going to be a very big year for a multitude of reasons. Obviously, we started in 2018 with a very basic idea, very small team. We got our FCA license in 2020. And then just last year, we were acquired by a very large company called Awanda. They do CFDs and FX commodities all over the world. They're registered in about 9 different countries and they want to get into digital assets. So they acquired us last year. It started a year before, but it took quite a long time to get it through the FCA approval. And now we're kind of up and ready to go. First project for this year is getting Awanda Crypto launched, which is their retail crypto platform. And then it's going to enable CoinPass to focus on corporates and pensions. Having one brand trying to address multiple audiences is very, very tough. And I'm not a marketing genius. I know the tech stuff and the product stuff and et cetera. So being able to focus on one type of investor class is kind of what CoinPass is going to specialize in. And it's going to be corporates, B2B, asset managers, pensions, et cetera. So our branding is going to change and the platform is going to change. One thing I really wanted to do for a while, which is kind of really boring when you explain it to people not like yourself, people that are outside of it. Like, I've had several people come to me over the last few years and say, how can you make crypto look like my ISA or look like my SIP? How can you make it simple that I'm just investing and managing a portfolio? So I think with this acquisition by Iwanda, and they're really good at retail, really good at active traders, we're going to focus on what we're better at as well, which is corporates with investing and with strategies.
I find it quite interesting because one of the things I'm probably not the generation that crypto is aimed at. I absolutely love it. I'm like always watching different YouTube videos and researching. Do you think there's a generation gap? Because at the moment, the people that got the money are 50 plus, the Gen Xers and the baby boomers.
It's a really, really good point, because when we first started, we thought, you know, our target audience were going to be from like kind of 20 to 35.
Yeah.
You know, the people that are kind of into crypto, and how it kind of formed is that the median age for our user base now is about kind of 32 to about 55. So they're a bit more educated, they're a bit more sophisticated, they've worked in the city at some point in their career, they have consulted, they have a property business, you know, they're a bit more, you know, a bit further through their lives, and they actually tend to deposit and invest quite heavily as well. So we can take care of the person who wants to buy their first bit of Bitcoin for like £100. We can do that any day of the week. That's not a problem. We don't judge and try and keep people away. But we find that the majority of our investors are doing, you know, a couple of £1,000 a month.
And had you investors, on a little note, in Bitcoin 15 years ago, you would have had more money today than any other asset class. It's gone up so much.
You know, getting in early, you know, and yeah, there's always the old adage. And this is where I think people fall into a bit of a trap, is Bitcoin when it was like less than a dollar, and look at it now. And some people think they can repeat that same activity with a penny stock or a low cap coin or something brand new that's come out now. It's like, oh, it's less than a cent. If you put £1,000 into it now, in 5 years, it could be this. Well, 5 years, it could be less than a cent, because it goes down to 8 decimal places, which is very low. But it comes down to like research and risk. We actually had a journalist do an experiment over a year where didn't know anything about crypto, came to our platform, wanted to kind of co-write something with us. I think he started with like £500. And every time there was a bit of profit, he would shave that profit off and do something with it. So he always kept his original investment there. And even though there was a couple of dips here and there, I think he finished up on the year, but he kind of had a bit of Bitcoin, a bit of Ethereum, and now he had like 15 other random tokens as well, you know. And he's able to swap in and out of them, versus like if you were doing stock and shares, you can buy some JP Morgan and then you can sell it. That's it. Whereas you could buy some Bitcoin and then flip that into some Ethereum, which you could flip into another token, which you could come back. There's so many different kind of options out there that once you have a little bit of profit and you have a little bit of experience, you can go and try the other parts of the market. If you're interested in artwork and NFTs, not my bag, you can go and try that. If you're into staking and getting some, you know, some cash flow off your idle assets, you can look at earn and staking rewards kind of stuff. So there is something literally out there for everybody.
Where can people sort of find out more about you and CoinPass?
Well, yeah, online stuff. I'm a little bit not as online as I probably should be at the moment. It's probably just work. There's got to be a work and a play, and I don't really have a lot of time. I think I don't get enough out of social media to bother. Obviously, everything's on our website at coinpass.com.
I have a final question. This is probably a bit of a mean one. So we've talked about Bitcoin. We've talked about the fact that 2024 is going to be an amazing year. What price prediction do you have for the end of the year for Bitcoin?
More than a pound. No, it's really hard. Now, I get asked this question a lot. And, you know, my idea of where Bitcoin could go is always changing. Can it go to the moon? Can it go to over 100,000? Well, yes, it can. Can it go down to zero? And I said, well, there's a possibility it could, but I think there's far too much invested in the infrastructure underneath it. And I think if the prices were to keep dipping, people would keep buying. So it's one of those self-fulfilling prophecies. I think the supply and demand macro game is going to play a big part this year, with institutions wanting to come in, offering this product out, they have to have something backing their fund. You can't just start, I'm going to have a Bitcoin ETF with no Bitcoin in it. They have to get it from somewhere. Let's never forget, there are still anonymous parties out there, or really, you know, very old school investors that are holding very, very large swaths of Bitcoin as well. And anytime they, we saw it, not in the ETF news, I think it was yesterday or this morning, 200,000 Bitcoin moving from wallet A to wallet B. Wasn't hit any exchange, but that's enough to kind of flurry a little bit of news. And that's something that's quite interesting about the space as well, is that there are Twitter bots watching every single transaction that happens online. As soon as there's a big one, it's posted up there for everyone to see. So there's kind of nowhere to hide. And that's why I think I find it the most interesting, is that you can see the money moving around in real time. What are the whale wallets doing? As soon as they get identified, they're identified forever. There's no hiding 200K of Bitcoin anywhere. As soon as it hits an exchange, cool, it's probably going to be sold. Or is it going to come out the other side back into another wallet? We can always see where the money's moving. There's no cloak and dagger. There's no smoke and mirrors. It's real-time transparency. I think there's more chance of it getting to newer all-time highs than it is going to zero. As for numbers, everyone's, you know, is it 50K? Is it 100? Is it 150? I don't think it really matters, because I'm buying every week no matter what the price is.